Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode, in 2005, Master Butcher Paddy O'Leary and his son David opened the first factory outlet butcher shop in Ireland and the Dublin Meat Company came into existence. They quickly became renowned for great value products and a commitment to innovation without ever compromising on taste or quality. As the years have unfolded, my guest today, Brian O'Leary, joined and together the family noticed a shift in eating behaviours. Sensing the demand for quick, healthier meal options, they took a bold step forward and in 2014 with the creation of Fit Foods Ready Meals. Fast forward to 2022 when significant investment in the Dublin Meat Company business by BGF Group resulted in the purchase of Swift Fine Foods by Dublin Meat Company and the founding of DMC Foods. Still proudly Irish owned and run by the O'Leary family, DMC Foods operates a 34,000 square foot manufacturing plant on the banks of Loch Agish. DMC Foods is a cornerstone of local employment with over 200 plus employees. Brian, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Right. Before we get down to the meat of the DMC story, the start of your career was very different from the world of healthy meal options, right? Do you want to tell us about that and then the decision to join the family business?
Yeah, so I after college, I went over to the UK. I had this idea that I wanted to get into the markets in some way, shape or form. My first job was actually with a broker. I was a runner in a brokerage business in the UK called Eurobrokers, 96-ish, I'm assuming. I got out from there. I met someone one night actually and I ended up getting into AIB. So I was on the syndicate loan desk in AIB for 6 months, well, nearly a year, I think, but I'm not an accountant. I was having nightmares about calculators, balance sheets and all that kind of stuff. So I blagged my way onto the FX desk and I was a proprietary FX trader over in the UK and doing a bit of options as well for seven, 8 years. I got a call from a bank, a headhunter, to join a bank in Ireland. My second brother, Barry's in the recruitment game. So I rang Barry and I said, listen, I'm getting a call from a bank in Ireland called Anglo. Never heard of them. What do you think? And he said, snapped their arm off. Really good bank.
You still tell me?
Everything's in hindsight. Really good bank. Paying good bonuses. Treat their staff really well. You should join them. So I came over. I joined Anglo. Again, I was a prop trader there on the trading floor, 4 or 5 really good years in Anglo on the trading floor. Fortunate enough, I left December 2007 before everything blew up. So
you rang the bell.
As my mum says, someone was praying for me.
Yeah.
And I went out and I started a small hedge fund with a pal of mine, doing FX, doing bit of prop trading with an office in Drumcondra, actually. 2008 wasn't a good year to be setting up hedge funds. So one, the year wasn't good. Two, I was so familiar with being on trading floors where you're bouncing ideas off people and you're throwing things around and it's noisy. I was stuck in an office on my own looking at screens. Yeah, it's your own money, it's family money and all that. So in fairness, we wrapped it up after about 6 months. We gave people back their money, in fairness. We didn't lose anything. And I was kind of at a bit of a loose end. My dad and my brother David, my younger brother, so three, I have two brothers. My younger brother David had set up. My dad was a butcher for years. He had a shop in Northside Shopping Centre called O'Leary's. But the rents in shopping centres at the time were just going north. They were crazy. And I think at the time they didn't want butchers in shopping centres because the phones were coming in. The shoe shops, the Marathon Sports, I think it was back then. Butchers are smelly and not sexy enough for the shopping centre. So they were pushing rents too high. So in fairness, my dad, he saw that. He got out. He opened up the first Dublin Meat Company in R10, the Butterley Business Park, in 2005, 2006. with my brother David, and it was the first factory outlet, right? I suppose what they used to call it, like, it was like the Ryanair of butchering. So they've totally revolutionized. It was low margins, high volume. He used to close on a Sunday, Monday, so he had a limited amount of staff, 5 days a week, and the volumes they were doing were crazy. People were traveling from everywhere to go up and stock up on their meat, and they did really, really well. So I saw that, and I was saying how good it was, how progressive it was. The concept was keep the margins low. It was a factory outlet, so there were the lads upstairs making, and it was all over wraps. It was totally different than working for, and I was fascinated with this. I just thought it was a fantastic idea. So I ended up saying to the lads, listen, I wanted to join the family business. The problem I had at the time was they thought it was crazy, because all they saw from the trading was, when I worked in the bank, was kiosks on a Thursday night, kiosks on a Friday night, the pinstripe suits, the credit cards behind the bar, the golf classics, you know, the big bonuses. Yeah. And don't get me wrong, it was fantastic, but they couldn't understand why I wanted to leave all that and in their eyes become a butcher. So that was the big thing. So, like, I basically bribed my brother and my dad to get into the business at the time. I joined in and around 2010, I'd say, 2010. And we went on. In fairness, my dad said, like, you're not going to come in and just sit in an office and tell people what to do. Because I had the idea of opening more shops. I want you to spend at least 6 months down on the counter, cutting meat and late nights and all this kind of carry on. In fairness, we did that. And then we went on to open.
Is your brother trained as a butcher?
Yeah, my brother and my youngest brother trained as a butcher. Now, we all worked in the shop as kids, so we'd have a fair idea, but we were never qualified. We were, you know, since we could walk, we were in the shop in Northside at weekends, at Christmas and all that kind of stuff. So we went on, we opened with six shops, really, really successful. Good times, you know, it was thriving back then. And then over time,
and with the shops, the factory type shops, or were a shop,
these were all factory type shops. So we started with the factory above the shop in Artane. So we had butchers up there producing for all the shops, and we had a van going out every night. So the whole concept was, I suppose, if you look at the main overheads of a retail butcher shops in particular, is your rent and your staff. Our rents were much, much lower than everywhere else, because we were in
business parks.
We were in a garage forecourt up in Drogheda. We were in a garden centre, you know, beside a garden centre in Kinsealy. And then your staff, we had butchers in the factory producing en masse and going out at night. So all we needed was two or three lads in the shops, you know, customer service essentially. But now there were still butchers, most of them at the time were butchers. But, you know, I always remember, we had a really busy shop in Artane. I think we only had four lads and one part-time lad working there. And with the numbers that was turning over, if you had a traditional shop doing the same thing, you probably would have needed 15 qualified butchers to do the same thing. So the concept was working. And at the time, we could see butchering, they were dwindling butchers. You know, that's butchers, you know, they're few and far between now. And we could see that at the time. So the concept worked. It was great. I suppose the next stage of that was Fitfield. So we saw in the shops a change in the culture. You know, I think we were saying earlier on, the lads are not drinking nearly as much. You know, they're calorie conscious. We had a factory at the time in Swords. We upgraded the factory in Artane to a factory in Swords, and there was a canteen there. And there used to be always sausages and rashers and breakfast rolls and all that. And they went from sausages and breakfast rolls to protein shakes, the turkey burgers. We're looking at this going, Jesus Christ.
What's going on?
You know, the Christmas parties went from pints of Guinness, pints of Budweiser, pints of Heineken to gin and tonics, the Slim 9 gin and tonics.
Yeah.
You know, so you can see a cultural shift with these lads. And I remember saying, like, you know, the difference in my opinion was, like, when I was growing up, I looked terrible, but I had loads of fun. These lads look great, but I don't think they have nearly as much crack than we did. You know, but that's
their choice. There you
go. We built a business on it.
Yeah.
So we came up with an idea of Fitfields.
Right.
In and around 2014. And I suppose the foundation of Fitfields back then, and it still is now, was a 400-gram microwave healthy ready meal.
Okay.
That's the foundation. And it just took off. it just took off. So
just another thing I wonder about it, because you mentioned the change in terms of the, you know, the social change with in terms of healthy eating and things like that. But I also wonder whether, you know, you look at something like that and all those Gen Zers now are living in apartments or living in flats, don't have the either equipment, the space or the ability to cook in the traditional sense, that actually, you know, having something that's very tasty and microwavable that they can whack in, and also probably work and don't have time to come home in the evening to start cooking.
I think that's the key. I think they don't have the interest or the time.
Yeah.
And I what I think as well, phones and, you know, social media and everything's instant.
Yeah.
Like, I want it now. Like, you know, to go home and say, right, you need to prepare your dinner, you know, I just don't think, I think those days are nearly gone.
Yeah.
It's now an occasion to have a Sunday dinner, you know, so I think that's gone in our favour as well. So that was the start of Fit Foods, I suppose. Started in the shops, went really, really well. So at the time, we were selling thousands and thousands of Fit Foods, and that was dragging more people into Dublin Meat Company, which proved really, really successful. Then we came on to the COVID. So at the start of COVID, so I was pushing a lot of retailers to take in these, and they wouldn't take them in. We ended up getting a break at the start of COVID in Lidl 2020, and I just took off. It was phenomenal. You know, now in fairness, on the back of the Fit Foods, we had a marketing person that I brought in, and it was fantastic. She created the brand. She created Fit Foods. She created the, we used to send out, we operated with these influencers. You know, we used to give out free stock. You know, at the time, we never ever paid an influencer. We just gave out the free stock, and then we're hoping that they tagged them or whatever. And they did, in fairness. Yeah. So that kind of went viral. 2022, went into Lidl, and it was just, from day one, it was crazy. There was people walking out with trays of meals, which was massively successful. I suppose rolling on then, we got a break in Tesco, on the back of Little Tesco, Dunn Stores. And then we did a deal in 2022 with BGF. BGF, or British Growth Fund, they are a massive private equity business in the UK, but they'll only ever take a minority stake. So they'll only ever build up to 40%. That's the way they operate. So they bought roughly 30% of my business, and it was a slightly complex transaction in that at the same time we bought 100% of the factory at the time up in Monaghan, who were making our meals. So we sold 30% of the business, used the proceeds to buy 100% of, it was called Swift Fine Foods.
And you know, that move from you know, the butchers to the ready meal, you know, while there's obviously similarities in that it's food, you're looking at a completely different skill set because you got cooked meals as opposed to completely
different animal.
Yeah.
Health and safety, food safety, it's completely different animal. Yeah. It's completely different animal.
And do you think that having the background in the butchery side of it was a help, or it made no difference because they were so different?
No, I think the butchers obviously helped. I think the butcher shops at the time were a great showcase for the product. And even when we came out with MPD, so the new product, we come up with a new product, and we say, throw it into the butchers for a month. You know straight away.
Yeah.
You know, that's where all the people at the time were buying the meals, were in the shops. Shops were selling so many ready meals. So it was a great showcase for the products. Then, you know, over time we brought out yogurts, puddings, pizzas. We have a meat range. We have a 500 gram range. So we built on this 400 gram range, but it's still the foundation. But it was a great... The shops still are a great opportunity for us to throw something in, and you just know. And the lads in the shops are with us so long, you know, they'll tell you
whether that's going to work or not.
They'll say, great product,
yeah,
it's a fad, it won't work, that'll be in the
top
three.
So the shops are almost just the test markets, and then if it works, it's going into the big retailers then.
Exactly.
And it's interesting that, you know, when you look at it now, have you always had a kind of an entrepreneurial gene, do you think? But, like, you know, when you were on trading floors in London and in Dublin, were you a bit of a frustrated entrepreneur, or do you think you're an accidental entrepreneur that just times happened and you saw the business, you saw what was happening in the Dublin Meat Company, and you're going, actually, do you know what? There's more to this.
No, like... I think I always had a bit of an entrepreneurial flair,
right,
somewhat. I suppose even if you look at the trading side of it, you know, I never liked to be told what to do.
Mm.
And even with the prop trading, you had a boss, but you didn't have a boss. You had your limit. So once you got to your limit during the day, that was your number.
Yeah.
You were gone. Go home.
Yeah.
You know, so now you obviously have people that you reported into. So it was slightly different. You were essentially working for yourself. I had my own limits. I had my own P&L. I could essentially, I wouldn't say do what I want, but you know.
But your own boss. Yeah, and
your own boss.
Yeah.
You're essentially your own boss.
Yeah, you know? On a day-to-day
basis. In that respect, it helped. But then I always had I was looking at my dad, I was looking at my brother, I was looking at, you know, even my second brother, Barry, has a recruitment business. So there's always an entrepreneurial fairness. I assume it's back to my parents who are entrepreneurial. So, yeah.
You mentioned your dad, and obviously he was talk to me about intergenerational conflict. Like, because when you came in, and as you said yourself, your dad said, listen, mate, you're not sitting at a desk all day. So even with that, and then the move from the Dublin Meat Company to the Fit Foods thing, like, talk me through that process and how he saw it.
So first and foremost, my dad thought I was off my rocker, like absolutely off my rocker, becoming a butcher. That in his eyes, I was becoming a butcher, and it was a massive strain on the family. And then when I got into the business, I was go, go, go. I wanted to go north. He was getting slightly older. He wanted to go south. And my brother David was caught somewhere in the middle, you know. So it was so difficult. It was so difficult. And it was small things like I wanted to bring in an EPOS system.
Mm-hmm.
You're off your rocker. It's too much money. My dad used to always bring money in the bank in a bag.
Yeah.
You know, I said, you can't do that anymore. You need to get safes in and bring Brinks. You know, that would cost too much money. But like, I could see 5, 6, 7 shops down the line.
Yeah.
You know, and my dad probably is old school, and it was not that this is the way we do it. You know, and I think at the back of it always was, you're actually off your rocker. What are you doing? So I ended up getting a guy. I was frustrated one evening, and I was on mentors.ie, and I ended up getting a guy called Tony Ritchie, and I met him, and I said, listen, this is pulling the whole family apart, because my girlfriend, I think at the time, I don't think it was married, girlfriend was getting pulled into, my mum's getting pulled into, my other brother Barry was getting pulled into,
and I'm not Kofi Annan here.
This is a disaster. This is a disaster. So we brought in a guy called Tony Ritchie, who's still on our board, who's still a mentor. You know, he's a superstar, this man. And he acted as a mediator, I suppose. So he started up with board meetings. So we're having a board meeting. My dad was going, Jesus Christ, we've two shops. We don't need a board. We're having a board meeting. This is the agenda. This is the structure. So we brought a bit of structure to it. And in fairness to Tony, he massively, we wouldn't have done it without Tony. But he sat in the middle. He pushed, he pulled, he prodded. You know, he was fantastic. He was absolutely fantastic. And he's still on the board. He's I'd speak to Tony every week.
And do you think that, like, and I think it's an awful lot of businesses, it happens to those businesses, particularly family businesses, you do sometimes need an outsider just to come in with no agenda, no dog in the fight, no nothing, that can just be able to look at both sides and understand both sides.
Yeah, 100%. And we're very, very close. You know, we're a really, really close family. We see a lot of each other. So it was so, so important. I mean, I wasn't prepared to jeopardize the whole family dynamic, but I knew there was something in this. I knew there was something in this. So, in fairness to Tony, he kind of pulled us all together, and he kept saying to me in the background, scale is the only thing that matters. You know, scale is the only, in business, scale is the only thing that matters.
And particularly, you know, when you look at the original Dublin Meat Company thing, that scale was key to that, because it was about volume.
Volume.
Just pumping volume. Pump, volume.
But then once you get to a factory, once you have a factory there, whether you have one shop, two shops or six shops, doesn't matter. It's just more steak, more mince, just get it out there. So, you know, from an economies of scale point of view, that was perfect. We don't need one marketing person, you only need one accountant.
Mm.
So that's what I could see, which made it a real business.
But your interest point there now, you know, scaling a business, right, takes a lot of skills that are very different to setting up the business in a way. Like, and maybe it's that dynamic of between you and your dad, and it could have easily been between a founder who had one shop, set it up and was very, very happy and was running it really well. But then it's a completely different set of skills to take that bit and scale it.
Yes, I'd be of the view that scaling is easy. You mean setting it up in the first place is getting the foundation, yeah, getting the concept, getting it, you know, getting it working. I think I'm not saying scaling is easy, but it's easier than setting it up. Like I'd speak to lads now and they've one shop or one coffee shop or whatever it may be, and that's the hard part. Mm. That's the hard part, is proving the concept, getting it right. Scaling it then is easier. I'm not saying it's easy, it's easier, but it's a different skill set. Mm. It's a completely, and that's where you need to bring in people that have done it before, or have the Tony Riches of this world, that has that experience, or give you the confidence.
Yeah, but you also you find, as you're starting to scale all those businesses, there's an awful lot of jobs that you suddenly are tasks or roles that you need in a scaled up business that you don't really need in a thing. Like, you know, if you think about it, things like marketing and all of that, right? If you've one shop, you are kind of the marketing department.
Yeah. You're the marketing, but commercial.
You're everything, right? Yeah. But as you start getting bigger, there's an awful lot of other roles that, and you know, and then God forbid we start going, well, you need some form of an IT department.
Funny enough, that kind of happened to us when we did the deal with BGF. You know, at the time it was myself, my brother. So my brother used to look after the meat. I used to look after kind of everything else. Then we had a marketing girl and an accountant. Mm. So, you know, that was it.
Yeah.
But once we did the deal with BGF, bought the factory and really scaled, then it was a commercial team, a marketing team, a CFO, a manufacturing director. It became... That's exactly what you're saying. Yeah. You know,
you needed all these other bits because that's what it requires to be fully fledged.
You need a depth within the marketing. You need someone else in commercial. You need someone else. So it was a different animal. And you also realise you can't do it all yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you're not good enough to do it all yourself. Yeah.
And you don't. The other thing too is, and I think that's a mistake an awful lot of people do, is they're afraid to either A, admit that, or B, either outsource or bring somebody in to do that. Right. And it just actually, it doesn't quite kill the business, but it really just dampens down the potential in the business.
So I suppose that's probably one of my biggest faults, I suppose, that it's a positive. I realise that I haven't got a clue about accountancy.
Yeah.
You know, I know the bits and pieces. I'm not a marketeer.
Yeah.
I'm not a commercial person. I don't know anything about ready meals.
Yeah.
I know bits and pieces of everything, but if that's the case, bring someone in that's better, that does. And then if you bring them in, you have to trust them. Yeah. No point in bringing in the best marketeer in the world.
No point in having a dog and marking yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, and saying, right, I want you to do this. That's the case, do it yourself.
Yeah. What do you think were the really big learnings for you in those first few years in DMC now? And then as you progressed it into the much bigger entity?
I suppose the learnings were the family side of it. You know, it was the pulling and pushing and, you know, the politics, I suppose, of just keeping the family on a level playing field. While in the back of your mind, you're kind of going, I can see 3, 4, 5, 6 shops. I can see Fifth Foods going here, there, everywhere. Yeah. And it's just balancing everything. And in fairness to my dad, he's old school, you know, and my dad and my brother were happy with one shop.
Yeah.
You know, they'd never been happier. And all of a sudden I come into the party and go, I think we want 2, 3, 4. Now, don't get me wrong, I think they would have opened more over time. But I could see that this could be huge.
Yeah.
You know, this could be huge.
You were kind of proactive, I suppose. They'd have been reactive in terms
of... Exactly. There could be a double A company everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and in fairness, they probably acted in a strange way to keep a little bit of a handbrake on me as well. So there was a bit of a balance, and Tony was great in that respect.
Yeah.
But like, what did I learn? Just persistence.
Right.
Just persistence. Just keep at it. Keep prodding.
Yeah. And the thing about family business, I always asked about this, particularly something like this, and you know, with the family being as core as it is to it, right? You never kind of get to switch off. Right, the business and the family. There is no demarcation, right? Like if you're in the early days, you're going around to see your mom and you're going to see your mom and your dad. Well, the business was going to, there was no question of going to see Mam and Dad just to talk about how are you getting on, Mam and Dad.
Family dinners. I remember sitting there and actually, you know, in fairness to the second brother, Barry, you know, he's sitting there, he's around on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday for dinner. You're saying, like, in fairness, I think he came up with Fitfield. It's like, we have this brand. Sorry, he came up with the name Fitfield. We have this brand. We're not sure what to call it. Should be this, that, and the other. He's going, Jesus Christ, fucking give me a break. You know, there's always something.
Yeah.
You know, and
he says, I just come here for me dinner.
Steak's expensive. What do you think we should do? And having a problem with the burger machine. Get me out of here.
It's not easy for him, I suppose, sitting on the outside, you know.
No, particularly at the beginning, because it was all so new to us. It was all so, and it was just us.
Yeah.
It was just us. So it was everything. It was everything. We were constantly talking about it. And there was always something up. There was always something up. So, yeah, that was the tricky. And in fairness, we're not too bad now.
Yeah.
You know, we've learned to switch off sometimes,
yeah.
Well, I'd say my family say I don't really switch off. I'm constant, whereas my brother David is quite the opposite, which is good, which is a good balance as well. Balance, so, yeah.
And is your dad out of it now?
He's out of it now. He's retired now. But in fairness, he still has an interest in it.
Yeah.
He still gives us a dig out where possible. He still has an input in some way, shape or form, you know. So, yeah, he's good. Both, thank God.
He knows where the lines are in terms of he's not kind of showing up every day, kind of going,
It's just gone so big.
Yeah.
You know, it's gone so big. You mean, I remember bringing my parents down to the factory or up to the factory in Monaghan. Like, there's over 200 people there. It's monstrous.
Yeah.
It's just the scale of it now, you know, is just beyond belief.
Let's talk about the culture within the business, because if you think about it, like when the shop started off and it was just the Dublin Meat Company, right? And that was a kind of an organic culture. You kind of got to where the culture is. But then when you bring in Swift from, you know, that had been operating the food side of it, there's a different culture. So talk to me about, first off, when you started off at the meat company, what the culture was all about. And then when you brought the other one in, how you blended them and how you then developed the thing in its new guise. So
back in the day, Dublin Meat Company, it was crack, it was busy, it was pints, it was, you know, the first two guys we hired, we still have working for us in the shop. So fantastic culture. And again, being busy and being successful always helps with the culture because it's positive. There's bonuses. You know, the lads are busy. The day flies, you know. Now, there's always stress. There's always issues, you know. And I'd like to think, you know, certainly back then, I'd like to think now that we were fair. If there was an issue, we were fair. And that would be my big thing. Is he fair?
Yeah.
Now, I'm assuming there's people out there who call me blah,
unfair.
Blah, you know, but whatever. But at least they say, right, he was fair.
Yeah.
That's all that matters. So I'd like to think we were fair. I'd like to think we were good little lads. And in fairness, we didn't and we don't have a huge turnover of staff. So I think that says it all, I suppose. But then once you get into Monaghan, you know, we bought this big factory in Monaghan. It's very, very difficult because, you know, I was probably naive thinking we have this fantastic culture in Dublin and we're just going to go up and plonk that this factory in Monaghan. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's, you know, we're two different animals altogether and it's a different business, you know. So that's proven tricky. And you also realise that you can't just all of a sudden get a load of dubs wobbling up the Monaghan and going, right, look at us. We want yous to be like us. So that has been tricky. Now we're getting there, but it takes time. It takes time and it takes a bit of give and take on both sides. And what I've also realised, it'll never be the same. You know, it'll never be, you know, the crew up Monaghan are never going to be the same as the crew up in Dublin, you know, and that's just...
Yeah, but you don't necessarily need them to be the same.
Don't need it to be at all.
You know, like, and I always say this because we've had people on past talking about, you know, that have operated in global companies, right? Big global companies. And I say, I don't think you can have one culture across a big global company where you have sites all the way around the world. There's kind of an ethos in terms of, look, we want to do this really well or something like that. But then how it's localized, it just
you'd have your foundations.
Yeah.
You'd have your foundations. But then, like, the lads in Monaghan are standing on the sidelines talking about different things that we're talking about on the sidelines about. You know what I mean? On a Saturday afternoon with the kids or a Sunday afternoon with the kids. That's just life. That's just reality, you know?
Yeah.
So that's proved tricky, but like, it's not easy. You know, that's part of the game. You just get on with it. You get on with it, you do your best.
There's an idea out there that, you know, with success comes the risk of distraction, right? And that in terms of you go down rabbit holes that you shouldn't go down, or you go into businesses that look tangential to you and it turns out to be a complete disaster, you know? Like, there must be lots of things now, particularly with the Fit Foods thing, that you kind of go, geez, we could stick the Fit Food label on that. We could stick, you know, in terms of that. So how do you balance the need for, if you will, new product generation with not going into things that you just won't work?
It's funny, we've had loads of opportunity over the years, and like we have a yogurt range in conjunction with a company called Cologne in Wexford. We have a protein pudding range, we have a pizza range, and it's great, but what I've realised over the years, my job is to fill the factory up in Mullen. You know, we have a ready meal business, we have a ready meal factory. So these things are all great, but they're all nice to have rather than must-haves. At the end of the day, my job is to fill that factory up and monitor, keep things as safe as possible from a food safety point of view and a health and safety point of view, and get as many ready meals produced and sold out of the factory and monitor. So there is a balance there. So we've kind of pivoted back into the factory. What can we do there? There was a stage, you know, probably 18 months ago, where we didn't have capacity in the factory. We were maxed out, but we did a massive investment last year. We were automated lines, and we've now capacity to go again and take the business to the next level. So all focus now is on the factory. Having said that, you still need to be operating. You know, there's always opportunistic moments where you look at, you know, there's three, four things that we're looking at the moment that we can kind of go,
it could be something.
I still have that entrepreneurial thing kind of going, do you know what, I think that'll work. You know, and at times you just have to go for it.
But like, I suppose the other thing too is the business is so well established now, none of those things are really going to be betting the business on, right? You know, they'll be tangential, and if they work great, they're another leg to the stool, right?
So I always look at it from the trading point of view, risk reward. Right, what's the risk associated and what's the potential reward? And if that balances, then you'd say, okay, based on your risk reward scenario here, it's worth doing. You know, so.
Now, you mentioned food safety, and obviously it's been in the newspapers a lot in the last few weeks. Tell me your thinking about what that does for the idea or the industry of ready meals, and then more importantly, what can you guys do in Fit Food that kind of differentiates yourself?
Yeah, so obviously there was an issue recently with one of our bigger competitors. And in fairness, you know, I know they're competitors, but you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. It's an absolute disaster. And the net effect of that was it pulled the whole category down. So people see issue with ready meals, and we're the market leader, and all of a sudden it's Fit Food. Nothing got to do with us. Thankfully, we have this accreditation, BRC AA+. It's the highest accreditation in food safety you can get in Ireland. That's the only thing I can concentrate on, is keep that accreditation. And, you know, it's like an insurance policy for your house. It costs a fortune. You never want to pay it.
But
in the event, there's your accreditation. So I think there's a bit of work there to drag the category back, you know. But I think with all these things, it will come back. The category will come back. You see now it's gone into, you know, salads and this thing. The reality of it is the likes of Listeria is everywhere. It's just about controlling it. And I suppose there's an educational piece to realise is that if you've a ready meal or if you, and if it's heating up properly, it's gone. It's gone, you know. So it hasn't been an ideal last few months. With all these things, with all these disasters come opportunities, you know. So you have to balance it in that respect as well. I think long term it'd be good for our business. Short term it is hurt, you know. But you know, I know the lads in that particular factory. It's never nice to see.
No, particularly for something like that, you know.
Particularly when it's dragging the whole category down with it. And it dragged retail down with it. Yeah. You know, the retailers got a big kicking with this.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Customers are great at telling you what's wrong with a product, but not necessarily telling you how to improve it or what to do about it. You know, so how do you kind of take on board customer feedback and things like that? Or is it, you know, going back to something you mentioned earlier about the fellas in the shop, that they'll know immediately whether it, you know, are they the kind of the best customer, if you will, rather than the customer?
Yeah, the lads will always give us an initial sniff as to what's going on. And then, you know, we launched two product a beef and mash and a bang bang chicken, and I rang my area manager, Niall, and I said to him straight away, and he said, they haven't taken off yet because it's August and it's hot and, you know, blah, blah, blah. He said, but they will be two good meals. Straight away, he knew, probably without even tasting, they will be two good meals. You know, then it's social media.
Mm.
Then it's social media. You know, within a week, within a month, you'll get reaction. You'll get reaction. So I suppose it's the lads in the shop, social media, and then it's repeat purchase. Because of the brand, people will always try it. But, you know, trying it's one thing. Repeat purchase. And then you'll see, like, the commercial team now, it's data, data, data. Back our day, it was just instinct. Yeah, you know, I think that's going to be a good meal. Yeah. You know, now it's data. So we can see, you're getting data back off the retailers on a weekly, nearly daily basis. And you can see order patterns. You know, is this going to be a good one? Is this going to be a fad? Is this, like, we've these fake away meals, which are kind of TikTok. You know, you kind of know you might get 6 months or a year out of them. The other ones are core.
Yeah.
That's going to be a long-term one. So,
but interesting, that thing that a fella mentioned about it's been August and it's not the time. You know, you've got to take that on board and remember next time when you're thinking about the timing of your product launch, you're going to say, well, there's no point in us flogging a meal through the month of August if it's never, you know, if it's a nice hearty soup and it's the middle of August.
Yeah, but in fairness, what we get spikes in September, back to school, kind of routine, and then January.
You're right.
Because believe it or not, the Irish people think you can drink your mallet off over in December and a few ready meals and a turkey burger will sort you out in January. Long may it last.
Where are you in terms of hiring talent or developing from within?
That's an interesting one. Like, so the biggest problem every business person that I know is talent, people. And it's at all levels. So, you know, getting factory operatives back in the day used to be easy, and it was getting the higher management and, you know, as you go higher, it was trickier.
Yeah.
Now getting factory operatives is tricky. You know, it's just staff labour in Ireland is so, so tricky. So we're at full employment. It's so, so tricky. I suppose loyalty is probably gone out the window, you know. So that's the big problem that we have and everybody has. We have to get on it.
Yeah.
It's life, you know what I mean? Like, I always say, like, if we're the only one having the problem, we're doing something wrong. If everyone's having the problem,
there's not a lot you can do.
You just have to get on it. You just have to be clever. You have to be tricky. And there's ways around it. Like, you know, I've always been of the view, and we did it from day one in Dublin Meat Company, you know, people have skin in the game.
Mm.
You know, so I remember doing you know, my accountant and my marketing girl at the time and my area manager, I sat in an office in Swords and I put in a yellow sticky. If I ever sell the business for over X, you'll get Y. If I ever sell the business over Y, you'll get Z. And they had that yellow sticky, and when it came the day, they got it and they rolled. So there's a bit of a loyalty associated with that as well.
Yeah.
So there's ways, but like I think ultimately, if you're fair with people, you treat them well, and if you're honest,
and it's a good place to work.
Yeah, you mean nobody jumps out of bed every morning and goes, "Jesus, I can't wait to go for work." Nobody, including myself.
No,
you know. So in that respect, you have to make it a good place to work. You have to be fair, and I think with the work-life balance with COVID and work from home, you have to be fair in that respect as well. There's certain jobs you can do it. Certain jobs just can't do it, you know. And with that comes trust, you know. Like, there's girls that work for me in the office and stores. I could see them 5 days a week, once in a month, but I know they're doing their work. I talked to them on the phone. The numbers are coming through. Couldn't care less if they're sitting in the office, sitting on the moon. Once the numbers are coming through. But then the issue there, I suppose, is the younger people coming through, they're not getting the experience of sitting in an office. No. That's the big issue, particularly in the game you're in, or the trading game, or you know, banking game. You know, you learn a lot from standing at the coffee machine, or you know, going for a pint after work.
Conversations,
overhearing how they act, how people are professional, etc. That's where you're lacking slightly. So I think that's a massive issue, not just in my business, just in general, is the younger people. Mm. It's just the nuts and bolts of actually working.
Yeah. You forget how much knowledge you pick up by osmosis, by just
100%.
Being around.
Yeah, 100%. You know? And that's been lost, but that's, I mean, that's the balance being working from home, isn't it? Yeah. You know, so.
As the boss, or and actually it's interesting because I think it's the same as a trader, right? You don't necessarily get better at the job, right? But you get quicker at making the important decisions. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree. I think as well that you realise that there's certain decisions you don't need to be involved in.
Yeah.
You know, so you get better at making the bigger decisions. You get better at deciding what you need to be involved in, what you don't need to be involved in. And there comes a stage where you have to say to people, listen,
nothing to do with me.
Don't want to know. Make a decision.
Yeah.
And if you fail and make a mistake, I'll back you 1,000,000%, which don't do it the next time.
Yeah.
You know, so I think you learn a little bit like that. But like, I'm reasonably hands-on. I speak to the guys, they'll probably say too much, but like...
Well, do you obsess about the small things in the business?
No, I don't think so anymore. I'm just too busy. Like, right. You mean, like, your family life as well, you know, you have your own life as well. So, you know, there's only so much you can think about. There's only so much you can worry about.
There's only a certain amount of bandwidth that you have.
Exactly, exactly. So I think I got better with that kind of stuff over the years.
Yeah. Fast or slow decision-making?
Fast.
That's from the trader.
Oh, yeah, Jesus, yeah. Too fast at times. Yeah.
And then how do you make decisions? Is it data-based or gut-based?
I'm gut-based, but in fairness, with the team I have, is data-based. So, you know, I would go, I think we should go right. Mm. And they would go, well, the data's saying go left. Yeah. And then eventually you'd say, well, I agree with you. We have a row in between. But like it's gone too big for gut.
Yeah.
You know, and in fairness, I wouldn't say anti-data. I probably didn't understand it.
Yeah.
But just when you see the data that you get, now you have to pay for all this data as well. But you see the data you can get and how beneficial it is for the business. Yeah. You have to be data-driven. You have to be data-driven. You have to trust it.
Yeah. Do you hate losing or love winning?
Jesus. Love winning.
Do you?
Yeah. Love winning. But I think in hating losing, you also love winning as well. I do love winning. Yeah, I do love winning.
As you think back over the business, has fear of failure ever been a driving force for you?
No, I don't think so. I think I'm a risk taker by nature.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
Again, it comes back to that risk and reward.
Risk and reward. But you need to be lucky.
Yeah.
Like, you need to be lucky. Yeah, I was going to ask
you that. What gets more credit for your success, luck or hard work?
Luck.
Yeah.
Like.
Right time, right place.
Right time, right place. We got a break in COVID.
Yeah.
You know. But with luck, you need to take advantage of the opportunities. Yeah. You know, you need to be there. You need to take. And I think all this comes back to relationships.
Yeah.
So what I've learned over the years is relationships, relationships, relationships. If you have the relationships with people, it will pay off over time.
Yeah.
It will pay off over time. So you build the relationships, you build the trust. You know, nice people want to deal with nice people.
Yeah.
You know, like I've no interest dealing with someone that's a flute. Yeah. Yeah. You know, like, you know, meet him, he's a flute. You know, I won't deal with him again. Yeah. You like... Go back to the start. You don't jump out of bed going to work every day. If you want to speak to someone, he's a nice guy.
You do, yeah. And I've said this so many times on this one. At the end of the day, people do business with people. Simple. It doesn't matter what the business is.
Yeah.
It makes no difference at all.
And you don't have to like them. You know, you just have to trust them
and respect them.
Respect them.
Yeah.
You know, you don't like, there's loads of lads I do business, lads and girls I do business with. And I wouldn't be rushing out to have a pint with them. Mm. They wouldn't be rushing out to have a pint. It doesn't matter. You don't have to be drinking pints with everyone you do business with. But once you respect them and you're honest and you're respectful, And it works both ways.
Yeah.
Business will happen.
Yeah.
It might not happen straight away, but it'll happen eventually. Yeah. Because when, especially when push comes to shove, they'll come back and go, he's a straight shooter.
Yeah.
He's honest. He won't mess me around.
Right. Yeah. If something goes wrong, he'll tell me and we'll sort it out.
And you can see with the likes of what happened in the industry over the last 6 weeks, people pull together.
Yeah.
People, you know, and they'll pull together with people who've been straight with them over the years. People that they trust and people that they perceive as honest. And that would be my, I'm 100%, I'm either all in or all out. But if I'm, it probably comes back to the trading, but if I'm all out, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
You know.
What characteristics do you think are most important for a CEO? What personal characteristics do you think are most important?
Trust.
Right.
I think you have to trust the people you have working with you, and honesty.
Okay.
I think you have to be honest.
And resilient?
Yeah, resilient to a certain degree. But if you have the right people around you, it's the people around me that run my business, not me. I mean, I'm floating around, you know. They're making the decisions. They're the ones sitting at the office now, you know, in the office now, making decisions, doing the graft.
Well, you're swanning off.
I'm floating around with you doing a podcast. But at the end of the day, these are the guys who do the graft.
Yeah.
You know, I'm pulling the strings in and around them. Like, I'm there if there's an issue or there's a big decision made, but these are the guys who are running the business.
Yeah.
You know, the lads in the shop, the managers in the shop, the area manager, the lads, they're running the shop.
Yeah.
They're selling the meat.
Yeah.
Not me. You know, so it's, you know, these are the guys who are doing it. And you need to trust them.
What advice would you give to young people now?
Starting off in business.
Starting off in life, starting off the career.
I was actually thinking about this on the way in. I was chatting to someone recently who had a bit of entrepreneurial flair, and my advice then was think long and hard about it, because it's not all frills, it's not as sexy as you may think, you know, and it's tough, and I don't think the climate, you know, that we're in is very supportive of smaller businesses in particular, and also you need to weigh up, what's the alternative? You know, there's loads of jobs out there. There's nothing wrong with working in the civil service.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong working in a bank. There's nothing wrong working, you know, and you need to weigh up again, back to your risk reward. Mm. If I can get $100,000 working in a bank or $50,000 working in whatever it may be, you know, you'd be a long time doing that.
Yeah.
A lot of sleepless nights,
yeah.
You know, so a lot of it comes down to climate. Like, we're full employment, the economy's flying. You know, I'd be thinking long and hard about it. Do you have the neck for this? Do you have the
do you really have the right idea for it? You know,
do you have the right idea, but are you the right person? Like, if it doesn't work, will you get back on the horse and go again? You know, so you know, that's like, in a strange way, the country's in a great place in that there's loads of jobs.
Yeah.
There's loads of really good jobs. But in on the flip side of that, it's not in a great place, because I don't think there's a lot of support and backing for the smaller businesses. You know, we're okay. Yeah. We're big enough now, but starting off, the red tape, the cost, the you know, it's all gone very, very PC. You know, it's tough.
Mm.
You know, it's tough. So the advice would be think long and hard about it.
The other thing I want to talk, we were talking about briefly there earlier on, in terms of like the young people, and like, there's always been this thing, oh, you go to college and things like that. But, you know, as you look at the butchers, right, there's not enough of them floating around. So this whole area of apprenticeships and things like that. You know, when we left school and things like that, you know, there was still a bit of apprenticeship. But then you went through this period where, oh no, you don't do apprenticeships in Enton. And now, you know, I had a guy on a couple of weeks ago, and he sold his IT business. And said, what advice would you give to young people? He says, become a plumber, because I can't get plumbers now to do my job. You know,
few and far between.
You know?
So you look at the butchers, the bakers, the candlestick makers, the barmen, right? People are not going into that trade, and probably rightly so. Mm. Like, it's a tough gig, butchers. Yeah. Your weekends, your long nights, it's cold, etc., because FDI, you can go up to Intel, you can go to these farmer plants and get a job. But the problem is, and this is a bigger issue, is like, all of a sudden Trump turns off that switch, these guys disappear. Who are employing people in and around the country, not just Dublin? You know, like, there'll always be small businesses. Mm-hmm. There might not always be the FDI.
Yeah.
So that cannot be lost. Mm-hmm. You know, people are always going to need meat. Yeah. People are always going to need,
you
know, having a pint.
And do you think there's a risk that skill set actually properly disappears?
Oh, it's gone. It's gone.
Is it?
It's gone. Like, there's no butchers out there. No one's getting into the trade. No one's getting into the trade. And it's not just butchers, you know, plumbers.
Yeah.
So it's a massive issue.
Yeah.
But, like, what do you do about it? Like, I mean, these pharmaceutical companies and these tech companies, they can pay 20-30% more.
And just mop loads of school leavers and grads.
Mop them up. And not only is the job, it's the 9 to 5 Monday to Friday, the subsidised canteen. You know, there's
warmth.
The warmth. They're sitting beside some young one from a different country who looks lovely. I mean, it's a massive thing, you know. And so I think that's a bigger problem in the country. What happens if this thing gets switched off, or and with your man at the helm over the US, who's to say?
Really easy to say. How do you feel about what you've already done in the company?
There's a sense of pride. Like it's still a family business. We've built a fantastic business. We've employed a huge amount of people. We probably have the guts of over 250 people employed overall now. I'd like to think we're fair. So yeah, there's a sense of pride, but I don't really overthink it, to be honest with you.
Do you celebrate the wins in the company?
Yes, I'd say we do. We don't overdo it, because it's been so busy for so long. There's always something. You know, we're launching into the UK next week, which will be it's a massive thing for us. But then once that happens, there's something else happening the following week. So it's constant. But yeah, we try to celebrate the wins.
Yeah.
You have to.
Right, we've come to the black book question.
Oh, Jesus.
I don't know. I've always as much trepidation when I open this book as the people I ask, right? Oh, I have looked
out. It's not about my hairdresser.
Looked out massively. And now who I see who has written the question, I'm not surprised, right? This is very good. If you could have a celebrity come on board as a brand ambassador, who would it be and why? I've looked out.
Jesus Christ. I'm going to be a bit controversial on this one.
Okay.
I go Roy Keane.
All right.
Right? Firstly, because I'd love to sit in a room and have a real good chat and a row with him over what happened in Saipan. Secondly, I think he's good. He resonates. And thirdly, I think he sell a lot of ready meals.
Well, it's funny. I have another question. Then I have to ask you. I have a question sometimes. You have a dinner party and there's 6 people, you, me, and 4 others. You'd be amazed how many times his name comes
up. Because he's controversial. There's a lot of people who
entertaining,
just sit there,
controversial, not bland.
He'll say something he shouldn't say. Yeah. There's a lot of people out there that it's, again, going back, it's all going to be PC.
Yeah.
You know, he'll say something that, jeez, I can't believe he said that.
Yeah.
But that's what gets it going.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, it's actually, you know, you look at some of the stuff he's been doing now in terms of the is a Vodafone he works for, the phone, like the ads are edgy, right? And but they're really, really good. Everybody likes them. Everybody talks about them.
And sorry, the other side of it is he was a genius.
Yeah.
He was one of the best footballers to ever play. He was, and what I love about him as well was he didn't have that much talent. And what I mean by that was he never was run by a player.
He wasn't a Luis Figo.
He wasn't a Damien Duff. But I remember reading something about him that one of the managers, might have been Brian Kerr or Mourinho, or someone said to him, or Clough said to him, what you're really good at doing is controlling the ball, passing and running. And he built a career in that. Didn't do anything else.
Yeah.
You never seen him run. You never seen him playing a 40-yard ball.
No.
Taking on a player. Controlled the ball, he passed it, and he ran up and down. Not rocket science.
Bit like business sometimes.
Keep it simple.
Well,
that's my philosophy. Keep it simple.
Yeah. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Brian O'Leary. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.